Hello and welcome to the third edition of Chicago Business Podcast. I am your host, Drew Sekula. I hope that people are making the most of this coronavirus social distancing that we're doing, but maybe programs like this can keep us better connected. So today I welcome Tony Yeager, an attorney with Chapman & Cutler, where he is a partner focused on private placements of very large deals, nine figures plus. So I think you'll find it both educational and entertaining. Thank you for joining us and welcome to the show. First, Tony Yeager, thanks for stopping over on this beautiful day.
Thanks for having me, Drew.
55 degrees.
It's a beautiful sunny day in Chicago in February.
Right. So, yeah, thanks for coming over. Great to have you as a guest on Chicago Business Podcast. You know, you are a local neighbor and someone who's world-class in what you do. So really wanted to just, have a conversation with you and talk about your ties to Chicago and talk about what you're doing and what's top of mind and current events and for you. So with that, maybe you can do a quick introduction. I know I can't do you all that much justice, except to know that you are the person, I believe, with the longest longevity that I know in their current position, who I guess you are an owner, but not the founder of the business. So maybe we can start there and kind of talk about your ties to Chicago and where you find yourself today.
Sure. I don't know how far you want me to go back, but I went to high school in the Chicago area. Mm-hmm. I went to law school at the University of Illinois. I joined Chapman & Cutler, a Chicago law firm, in 1989, and I've been practicing in the corporate finance group at Chapman & Cutler since 1989. My basic practice is private placements, mostly representing lenders. I've spent basically the entire last 30 years doing all sorts of different private placements, trying to think of what else. I'm currently the practice group leader for corporate finance at Chapman & Cutler. We have six offices now: New York, Charlotte, D.C., Chicago, Salt Lake, and San Francisco. I'm also the president of the American College of Investment Counsel, which is a group that of lawyers, both in-house and outside counsels, who meet to discuss issues related to corporate finance and private placements.
So was that the conference you're at down in Florida recently that you chaired, or is that something different?
That's actually something different. It is a private placement conference. It's not for the ACIC. It's for another organization that really is mostly focused, business side focused rather than legal focused. That conference has a number of investors, investment bankers, issuers who all show up to meet, talk about what they're going to do for the year in the private placement market, talk about what investments they might be looking for. Issuers talk about what sort of issuances they might want to do, and investment bankers, of course, talking to both sides to try to find matches and get people together.
Nice. That sounds. And you were the chair of that conference. Is that all right?
Yeah, I chair that conference every year, which means I get to introduce all the actual speakers and kind of keep things moving throughout the day.
Sounds good. Well, it sounds like you have more experience with what I'm trying to do here than I do, but but that's okay. It's that's great. So another thing I didn't hear you touch on that we've spent some time discussing before is the work that you do in the sports industry, and I think that still even is private placement, but you haven't touched too much on that. Maybe before we go deeper into the private placement discussion, can you give us a little background about the work you do with professional sports?
Sure, Drew, that's a good question. I've, as part of my private placement work, I had for years done private placements representing lenders loaning money to sports teams in the four major professional sports. I've also helped finance some of the stadiums that have been built recently, and we've done a little bit of work in Premier League soccer, helping a team or two get some financing as well. So a little bit of everything there, stadium, team, league-wide, a little bit of everything.
Nice. The and you lead this group then for Chapman and Cutler, is that right?
Yeah, we have about 20, 25 professionals who do nothing but private placements. And, you know, when I talk about private placements, it means any issuance of privately placed security, so obviously not offered or sold publicly. And they can come in different formats. They can be, you know, senior unsecured deals, senior secured deals. They can be mezzanine deals or other subordinated transactions. We also do a fair amount of leasing work, like credit tenant leases and other types of leases that are financed, and therefore debt financing is part of the process.
Okay, so I'm going to ask a stupid question.
Okay.
What is your definition of a private placement? Just to kind of level set for everybody and for people, like, I think kind of know pretty well, but...
No, that's not a stupid question, Drew. That's actually a good question. When we think of private placements, like at our firm, anything that's not going to be registered and listed on a public market is a private placement. And so we draw the line at, like, I've never done a deal that's listed on an exchange. Whereas the guys upstairs, you know, we have a whole group of people who do public deals, and those are all deals that are listed on exchange, offered publicly, et cetera, et cetera. So all of our deals are done under the 4A exemption for private placements.
Okay. And so it's on both the debt and equity side, or is this mostly just a debt play?
The vast majority of the transactions we work on are debt transactions. We do a little bit of equity here and there. We've all done some over time, but 80 to 90% are debt private placements.
So can you give us a little bit more color for the types of clients that, like, where are you a fit? And so companies doing what types of deals?
So we represent mostly large insurance companies, funds, groups like that, banks occasionally. And what they're typically looking for is a investment grade debt fixed rate security. So, and looking for, you know, relatively large numbers. Most of the deals I do are probably in the, you know, start at $100 million and can go as high. We did a deal a year and a half ago for, you know, $1 billion of debt in one financing. So we're mostly looking at, again, fixed rate, senior, unsecured, investment grade, in any industry, manufacturer, REITs, sports, as you mentioned, runs the gamut through, just depending on who's borrowing money.
Mm-hmm. And then, but in terms of size, and the size of the transaction that you're on, you're looking at, I think you said $100 million and up for transactions, and you're generally representing the lender.
Those are both correct, Drew.
Yeah.
And usually it's actually a group of lenders. It'll be a group of insurance companies or banks or whoever it is, but it'll usually be a group. It's rarely just one. But we have done smaller deals, one-offs. You know, occasionally we'll do a deal on the much smaller side. I mean, private placements could be a couple $1 million, right? It doesn't have to be $100 million. It's just with our clientele, the numbers they need to invest are so big that, you know, doing much that's small just isn't valuable to them.
So I think we're going to have some people in the real estate industry specifically who hopefully pulling a broad audience, but I know there'll be some people who are interested in the work that you've done for real estate investment trusts. So can you talk a little bit more about how REITs come into play with your business or some of the intricacies of them?
Sure. REITs have found recently the private placement market to be a valuable market for a couple reasons. One, they've discovered that they can raise significant amounts of senior fixed rate unsecured funds in the private placement market, which gives them some flexibility and allows them to custom tailor maturities, interest rates, delayed closings, a whole bunch of factors that allow them to really tailor to their capital needs funding that, again, is unsecured. So it's keeping their assets available to be secured by other deals. Now, you will be subject to various covenants, unencumbered assets, debt to cap, things like that. But, you know, at the end of the day, these are unsecured deals and allow a fair amount of flexibility to the REITs, who are the borrowers in these transactions. And so they found them very attractive as a way to raise large amounts of long-term capital. I guess that's the other thing I should mention. Our guys are willing to go 10, 12, 15 years and even longer. And so they find it's a very, especially with rates where they are, it's a very attractive way to raise capital.
Nice. Yeah, I think there could be some people out there who might be interested in learning more. So, all right, maybe take a step back and talk, yeah, a little bit more about your origin story. I know we talked about briefly in the intro, but you are a Chicago guy from the beginning. I think you were, I know you grew up around here. I don't recall where you were born, but I know you met your wife down at University of Illinois, as did I. So we have some things in common besides sharing a property line. So maybe if you could talk a little bit more about your origin story and your early path, and like, when did you figure out, you know, you wanted to be an attorney, and how did that all play out?
Sure, that's a good question, Drew. As an undergrad, I went to the University of Michigan for undergrad, and I was an accounting major, and so I took the CPA and blah, blah, blah. But then I was offered a scholarship to go to the University of Illinois to go to law school, so I decided to go. But because of the sort of CPA background, I was always pretty sure I didn't want to be a litigator. I always assumed I would want to be on the business side in some capacity. So when I was looking at summer associate opportunities at the time, Chapman and Cutler was one of the biggest finance firms in the city and really had very little on the litigation side, some bankruptcy litigation, but on the regular litigation side, they didn't do very much. And so it seemed like a good probability that if I went to Chapman and Cutler, I would be I would get to do a lot of finance type work. And so I did, and I enjoyed it. And so when it came time to pick a firm to go back to after law school ended, I went back to Chapman and Cutler. There I started the corporate finance department, which again, you know, private placements, private equity, leases, stuff like that. And I started with a group of guys who were doing private placements. And so that was really my introduction and start in doing private placement law.
Nice. Excuse my clock there. Sorry about that. But how about a little more background on Chapman and Cutler and kind of what, tell us a little bit more about the firm and outside of your kind of what your other sweet spots are.
Sure. Chapman and Cutler is a full service firm, we like to say. Focused on finance is our motto. We have one of the biggest municipal departments in the country, and we're famous for our municipal bond work. In addition, we do, banking work. We started so we've been in the same Harris Bank building for 100 and some odd years now, 105 or 110 years now, because we started as Chapman was Harris's nephew. I hope I'm getting the story right. But Chapman was Harris's nephew. And so when the Harris Bank needed somebody to write bond opinions, Chapman started writing those opinions. And that's how we ended up in the Harris Bank building, which still today we're in the original brick building on Monroe Street there that's, 140 years old or however old it is, I don't know. But we've been in the same building for 110 years or whatever. And we always joke we still have our first client. Harris Bank is still a major client of our banking group. So we still have our, first client. We also do a lot of fund formation and representing funds and boards of directors and things like that. We obviously do tax work and ERISA work, bankruptcy, trying to think of what else. We do have a litigation department, notwithstanding my early comments. We do some commercial litigation as well. But most of our practice is focused on investors, lenders, and helping them with whatever it may be in terms of public, private, bankruptcy, whatever it is.
Right. So in terms of the, for your practice, you have offices obviously outside of Chicago, and the work that you're doing is really certainly nationwide. Are you getting involved in a lot of international deals as well, or Or is it mostly...
We do. One of the interesting things that's happened in the last, say, 20 years is that a number of foreign issuers have seen the U.S. private placement market as a very attractive market in which to issue long-term senior debt. And so we've had a number of issuers from around the world. I've done deals with German issuers, Netherlands, UK, many times, obviously, Ireland, many other countries around the world issuing in the U.S. market. And so we end up working on what we refer to as cross-border private placements, but just a private placement where the issuer is issuing out of some other country into the U.S. private placement market. And so we do have, we have a law firm that we partner with on a regular basis out of the UK, and they have offices in Ireland and Korea and a few other places.
Nice. So that sounds like one of, a trend in your business. What are some of the other hot topics and some of the things that are changing and kind of the innovation that's happening within your...
Well, I think on the private placement side in particular, one of the things that's really made our market grow and dynamic is that our investors have been willing to give issuers flexibility in terms of delayed fundings and multiple tranches and, flexibility on covenants for mergers or for acquisition spikes or things like that. So we've really seen as time's gone on, one of the really, and I just heard about this in Miami when I was down there, issuers really appreciate the flexibility both on, the issuance itself and then what goes into the document that they can get on long-term money from private placement investors, right? I mean, your banks, you're talking 1 year, 2 year, maybe 5 years, whereas on our side of the table at the in a private placement, we're talking, we can go 10, we can go 15, we can even go 20 or 30. I mean, the issue for these insurance companies, right, is you pay your policy every month, right? And they know someday, statistically, they got to pay you back, mm-hmm. right? And so when that, actuarially, they can figure out when they need money. And from that, so they like long-term, stable, fixed-rate deals because they can put that into their, match that to a liability that's coming due in 10 or 15 years, and they know the money's there. And so that works very well for our particular clients, which is a much different structure than what banks have in terms of lending and borrowing constantly.
So what do the borrowers then look like? What's kind of their composition?
Most of our deals, the borrowers are every insurance company you can name. I guarantee you, whoever you pay your policy premiums to, they're one of our clients.
Yeah, but I mean borrowers.
Borrower, not lender. Sorry, my bad, Drew. Good question. Again, the typical private placement borrower that we see in our market is a most usually privately held company, but good fundamentals, investment grade, and growing, expanding, needing capital beyond what their banks can provide them in the short term. What we see with a lot of these companies is they've been drawing on a bank line forever, and they're constantly rolling that over and rolling that over and rolling that over, and eventually they figure out we can lock in, a base amount of debt for 10 years or whatever mm-hmm. and not think about it again. And so I think that's very interesting to them to get that locked in, and get away from living off their bank lines.
Right. Yeah. Just term out some of the debt and you know what you're dealing with there and you're not subject to the, that floating rate.
Right.
It's funny. Yeah. Did some of that work, some years ago as CFO at Independence Plus where we termed out some debt and it gave us a lot more flexibility. Well, knowledge about what it was going to look like and foresight, and then plan the business around
right. Exactly. That's a very good point, Drew. Is it gives the business owner, or the accounting staff, or whoever, a lot more certainty, so they can plan. They know what their debt costs are going to be, and so they can do a lot more forecasting, planning, that kind of stuff.
So, in terms of covenants, I assume there's normal debt service covenants. And then what about recourse. What does that look like with these deals?
Sure. The average private placement is going to be recourse to the issuer, but it's going to be unsecured. So secured lenders would come ahead of the private placement. And usually, probably the best way to think of it in general is what the private placement lenders are going to expect is they get the basically the same financial covenants that the bank has. So I've almost never seen it where an issuer comes to market and they don't already have a bank line in place, right? If they don't need a bank line, they probably don't need a 10-year private placement or 15-year private placement. So when they come to the market, and the first thing we do, one of the first diligence items we do is we look at their bank deal and look at what their covenants are like. And usually that's where you're going to end up. What our investors are looking for are covenants, financial covenants that leave them in a position to make clear that as long as the company meets those covenants, they'll be an investment grade company. One of the issues for insurance companies in particular when they do private placements is they have to submit their investments to the NAIC, and the NAIC assigns them a rating. It's 1 through 5 or 1 through 6. Now, usually those ratings match what a public rating would be, and in many cases they actually go out and get a public rating to show the NAIC what they're rated. But in any event, for the insurance companies, your capital charge that you have to hold against the asset is very small at like a 1 or 2, so investment grade. You know, 1 say A or better, and 2 say triple B minus and better. But once you drop down to 3 and 4, the capital charges get much, much, much higher. And so it's a more difficult proposition for the insurance companies in particular to go into the non-investment grade space. They all do some, but it has to be a pretty attractive deal. They also have any number of them who started out as 1s and 2s investment grade and for a variety of reasons have fallen and now they're 3 or 4. And, you know, it's unfortunate, but it is what it is. And, you know, everybody tries to work it out and find a resolution that works for everybody. But most of what they're going to do is investment grade.
Okay.
So let me just add this to just to give you the full picture. You're really looking at an issuer, to your first question or question from a minute ago, you're looking at an issuer who's done pretty well. They have a growing, expanding, solid, nice business, but they're probably not at a level where it's worth the time, expense, hassle, et cetera, to go public. And so it's easier for them, easier, quicker, less invasive to do a private placement. Whereas, you know, if they're so big that they can go into the private public market or they're already public with their equity, they may feel like it's easier to just do a public deal.
So what about closely held entities, though? So that whole discussion on recourse was good, but I was thinking also about like personal recourse, and you can have good sized businesses that are closely held. Does personal recourse not come into play in these deals at all, or it depends on kind of where the assets are?
Typically not if we're doing because probably if the business is at a level where it can get an investment grade rating, we're not worried about having the founders or the owners on the hook. That being said, in some of the mezzanine work we do or other below investment grade, there you're often looking at smaller companies. You're looking at companies where maybe the founder's a critical part of it. And so there you may either want some sort of guarantee from the owners. But more likely, and what we see in a lot of deals, are changes of control. If there's somebody or some group of people who are critically important to the business, we're going to want to be able to say, look, if you guys sell out, we get a chance to decide if we want to stay with the new owners or we want to put the money, the debt back to the issuer to get us paid off. And so a lot of the deals we do have change of controls so that, again, if there's a person or group of persons that we're concerned about, or maybe it's an alternative, which is we like the company today. We may not like it if it was bought out by Irv the Liquidator or someone like that. And so we may have a different type of change of control, which is if anybody gets control other than the current owners, you know, then we also have a right to put our securities back in the company. And it's just protection so that if they, you know, if something changes and we don't like the direction ownership's going or might go in the future, we can have a look-see. Now, those prepayments are usually a par, no make-whole or premium, so they're, you know, in a way, an inexpensive out for the company because we're not getting a premium.
Nice. So in this industry then, how has it changed? And what does innovation look like within your business?
Well, you know, if you go back 30 years, a lot of stuff's changed. First of all, you know, 30 years ago, the deals were smaller. They were 10, 20, 30 million. People couldn't really conceive of billion-dollar deals or $500 million deals, and now we do them every day of the week. Just the between the technology, you know, when I started, nobody had a computer on their desk. It was a big deal when they started putting computers on people's desks, right? So, and some of my older partners back then, or when I was an associate, you know, the partners back then used to joke about you couldn't do big deals because you could only get four pieces of carbon in the typewriter to make four copies of the note agreement, right, or whatever it is. And so, but over time, obviously, technology's made that a lot easier. The ability to email stuff rather than FedEx it has made deals go much faster. And so, you know, that's certainly good for the issuer. We can move much quicker than we could years ago. Also, in the private placement industry, if you look on the ACIC's website, aciclaw.org, there's a industry standard model form note agreement that pretty much everybody in the industry uses as a starting point. And what that does, well, it does two things. One, it gives a baseline for both sides, and it's been vetted by both issuers' counsel and investors' counsel to try to make it fair. And so you've got a baseline to start with, and also it's something that everybody in the industry knows well. And so most deals start with that model form. Now, what it doesn't do, because these need to be tailored for every deal, is have particular prepayments or particular covenants, financial covenants. You know, it has some housekeeping covenants, like maintaining your legal existence or something like that, but it doesn't have financial covenants, for instance, like your net worth or your debt cap or those kind of things, because those are considered, you know, sort of bespoke for each deal. And so those are typically, but what it does is it makes sure you spend your time negotiating the financial covenants, not on the boilerplate and the housekeeping right. stuff. And so, you know, that came in the late 90s, and that's been a huge boost to the industry in terms of moving quicker and having people's expectations from the outset be sort of level set. You don't have somebody coming in thinking they're getting a bank document, which look, while they do a lot of the same things, they look a fair amount different than model form note agreement, but now everybody can see it. It's online. There's a couple different forms. There's forms for NAIC ones or A minus credits and better, and there's NAIC twos, triple B minus and better. And there's also the same two note agreements for cross border deals because there's some different tax and indemnity and other things that go into cross border deals. And so you have technically four note agreements on the ACIC website, all of which are starting points that most everybody uses in the private placement industry.
That's great. It really allows people to work smarter, right? And you're not, you know, yeah, starting from that base form, and you can kind of stipulate to, okay, this is the framework, and then talk about the actual issues on the deal.
Right. We've really gotten away from the line by line on housekeeping covenants or housekeeping reps and warranties, things like that. We've really gotten away from wasting a lot of time on that stuff. People still go through them and they want to put a material here, material there, or they want something to match up to their bank deal rep or something. That's fine. I mean, there's a little bit of pushing and shoving now and then, but certainly not nearly the level there used to be, you know, a jillion years ago. And again, I guess the other thing that's just incredible is technology. You know, when I started, the big new technology was FedEx, right? I mean, at first, when you send something FedEx, the post office wouldn't let you do it unless you could testify or swear or whatever that was of high dollar value, right? Mm. You weren't supposed to use FedEx as like a regular email or regular mail service. And so, you know, that was sort of the new technology then. And I remember when I was a young associate, the FedEx used to come to our office at 8:45 every night to pick up. And so it was always a big scramble to make sure documents were, you know, drafted, proof, blacklined, all that stuff, a lot of which we take for granted now because it's personal computers. I mean, I was blacklining by hand when I first started. And then getting them copied, getting them into envelopes, and getting them to the FedEx guy before 8:45 when he was standing there in our mailroom. So that was a big deal at one point. Now, you know, we rarely send stuff FedEx because we can just email it whenever we want. We can email it today, tomorrow, tonight. You know, it's really made for a different way to practice.
How important are wet signatures anymore?
It's a good question. We still want them as a practical matter. You know, we routinely close on emailed signatures and get the originals later. You know, many states have acts now that say, you know, if you've made a mark that was intended to be your signature, it's fine. Or taken an act to intend to be a signatory, then it's fine. So, you know, we do actually get original security still notes, and we like those to be signed and have a wet signature. Most other things, it's a little bit less of an issue, but we still do get them.
How about, I know over the last 10 years, maybe it's even been a little bit longer, there's been a big move in the legal industry to move away from hourly fees and work more on a flat fee basis. Has that impacted you, and if so, how?
Yes and no. The practice we do is not terribly oriented in a way that makes sense to have fixed fees, in that one of the issues we run into, and really lenders counsel would say this, or sorry, issuers counsel would say the same thing we would say, which is, you know, a large part of how much I'm going to run up in fees is how's the issuer going to act, and more importantly, probably how's their counsel going to act. And their counsel would say the same thing about us and our clients, right? And so it's somewhat of a difficult process. That being said, you know, we do see fixed fee deals occasionally. Part of the issue is ethical, right? I mean, there are ethics rules under the state of Illinois that require you to, you know, obviously represent your client zealously and all that. And there's a question of if you're, you know, hitting a cap, or you actually representing your client, you know, so things like that. So we do have to keep ethical considerations in mind. And certainly, you know, we would want our clients to be on board with us if we were going to, you know, I guess I should back up and say the typical private placement issuer pays all expenses, right? Our clients bid an all-in price when they bid the interest rate. So our clients don't pay us. The issuer pays us out of the deal proceeds. The issuer pays the investment bank who puts the deal together, and the issuer pays their own counsel. If there's a rating, the issuer pays the rating agency. And so we're structured a little bit differently than our own clients typically. Occasionally in a deal, depending on the deal they might, but most deals they don't pay us.
All right.
They don't pay us directly, I should
right,
say.
Right.
They pay us through the rate they're bidding.
Right. We get it. Cool. So, taking a step back, what does kind of workforce look like for you, and specifically around recruiting and, you know, people who are either in law school now or considering that as a step ahead? I know I've heard, I think, both sides of it in terms of there being oversupply as well as not bringing enough people in. So what does that look like for you, and what's your perspective?
Sure, that's a good question, Drew. I was just talking about this at George Washington Law School this past week. There's always a need for good quality lawyers. There will always be a place for, you know, high-end, high-quality, smart lawyers. Do we have an oversupply of lawyers, maybe, or is it maybe more a mismatch of skills versus what's needed? I don't know, but you know, there's always a place for you know, good practicing attorneys. I mean, there just is, and so we're always looking for people. We're always looking for good people. I mean, to grow our business, and really even to replace us as people retire and this and that. I mean, you know, in my own practice, I have two main attorneys, associate attorneys, who do a fair amount of my work with me. And, you know, those, I need them to learn my practice well enough so that when I move on, because I've been there 30 years now, when I move on, they can take over and it's seamless. And because I do want that work to continue, I want it to stay with our firm, and I want them to be successful. So, you know, it is important. We can't just, you know, as partners in a law firm, just go, we're going to outsource everything to, you know, wherever. Because then there's no continuity. There's no, at what point does the firm just collapse because nobody's actually there anymore?
Right. Well, doesn't seem like that's been an issue for you guys up until now, right? And yeah, you definitely want to keep that going to, you know, hopefully, I don't know, some of those pensions still look pretty well in the law firm. So, you know, you want to keep it growing. I know that from my days in the Big Four, that's for sure. Yeah. So. Great. Well, is there anything else you wanted to touch on? We skipped right over the icebreaker with the drink of the day. You went with the H2O, the water.
Yep, so H2O.
I've learned that I have to give a little bit of a heads up so we can get extra creative there. We did the water today.
No, I'm good. I may partake after this, but I better go with water for now.
There you go. Well, I'll still cheers you. I heard an interesting toast over the weekend here. And I'm just trying. Just give me a second. To adventure and fellowship.
Cheers.
Cheers.
And our golf games.
And our golf games. We can get out there soon, hopefully. Thanks, Tony. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, Drew. That's great.
Yeah, take care.